Eku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imuna okea aha, o okolo kolo ki iki hanahano, okomoko aina o Hawaii. Inai mai, imalio mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Inoho ilalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case. Case number SCWC-23-000049. Yuki Gleason, petitioner appellant versus administrative director of the courts, State of Hawaii, respondent appellee. Arguing for petitioner, Yuki Gleason, Kevin O'Grady. Arguing for amicus curiae, ACLU of Hawaii Foundation, Emily Hills. Arguing for the respondent, Administrative Director of the Courts, Deputy Solicitor General, Siana Gualano. Argument on the merits.
Morning, everybody. Today's proceedings are being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel and also on Olelo. Also want to welcome to our court our two substitute justices from the First Circuit, Judge Shirley Kawamura and Judge Kevin Morricone. Thank you for joining us. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Okay. I understand you folks have split your time up. You're going to take 18 minutes with a two-minute rebuttal?
That's correct.
And 10 minutes for your counsel?
Yes.
All right. And you're going to go with a five-minute warning? All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Standardized field sobriety tests are a search for evidence. This evidence includes personal and private coordinative characteristics, as well as a person's ability to understand, process, follow, and demonstrate what a person believes they have been told to do after having been seized and while under the pressure of a police officer's subjective gaze and while in public. That is, if the person so chooses, because SFSTs are purely voluntary. A driver has the right to decline to answer questions, speak, perform demonstrations, and engage in so-called field sobriety tests. Although the driver was seized, the driver has a substantive due process and privacy right to be left alone and to ensure their own autonomy, that is, to not perform physical acts for subjective review. The Ballesteros case shows that the declination to perform SFSTs, answering no, under firm, is being used as substantial guilt of DUI through an inference of consciousness of guilt. But Tsujimura tells us that the Fifth Amendment and substantive due process prohibits the fact finder from using silence against the defendant. Uchima provides that any answer to the question regarding consent to perform SFSTs is neither exculpatory nor inculpatory. Trainer and Wan provide that a person may decline to consent to an encounter or a search. Bode Close provides that a person may not be punished for declining to perform a reenactment or demonstration of a physical event that occurred. A person has the constitutional right to be left alone. The government must produce evidence from its own work, not through forced physical actions. A person cannot be punished for exercising a right, including the right, to not provide evidence to the police or to perform actions, and they cannot be punished for stating that they exercised the right to decline to provide evidence. This court should overrule firm. I welcome the court's questions.
Well, I'll start. So you asked us to overturn firm. It seems like you don't ask us to really disturb Wyatt. It's sort of like Wyatt with a twist a little bit, right? Add a consent component.
So in Wyatt, the issue of whether or not there was valid consent was never raised because Ms. Wyatt herself voluntarily consented to perform SFSTs. And in fact, no consent issue was raised on appeal because she had voluntarily consented. This court's analysis in that case with regard to privacy and the right of expectation of privacy to be left alone is really not very deep because Ms. Wyatt agreed to perform the SFSTs.
So your answer is yes.
I'm not asking that you disturb quiet.
And you're asking for a consent aspect to Wyatt, is that right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this then. If we don't agree with your Wyatt position and we don't disturb Wyatt, is there anything left with your argument that you have made, not what the ACLU has made?
Yes, I think so, because from the beginning, part of what I raised is that there is a privacy aspect of being able to decline, and you cannot use a person's choice to decline to provide an SFST against them, which is what is being used in this case. So as I understand it, the court did not take the other question regarding Wyatt. So if SFSTs are a search, or there's even if we don't call them a search by name, if they are some effort to try and gather evidence by the police, consent is required. And if there is a declination to provide the SFSTs, that cannot be used against the driver.
Okay, but why it's saying that it's not communication, it's a testimony. It's physical characteristics that's being looked for.
I'm sorry?
Wyatt is saying that it's not a search, it's not asking, it's not looking for self-incrimination, but just not asking for testimony or communications.
Yeah, so the performance of the field sobriety tests are, if this court says they're not a search, there's still something that the driver doesn't have any obligation to perform. And here, the officer is asking the person to provide additional information with regard to the DUI, and the driver is under no obligation to assist them in any way. And the problem with FIRM is that it takes that declination to participate in the investigation in some way, whether or not SFSTs are a search or not. It asks them to provide information. And the problem with FIRM is by the driver saying, I'm just not going to do the thing that you want me to do, these field sobriety tests.
Right, but that's in combination with glassy eyes, watery eyes, flushed face, strong odor of alcohol swerving all over the roadway. Don't you have those additional factors that make it a permissible inference?
No, it cannot be a permissible inference.
But it's not in a vacuum now, what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that you cannot...
It's not just a no. It's in combination with everything else the officer has observed.
The no must be excised from the combination of everything else that the officer observed. If the officer observes watery and red and glassy eyes, indicative of alcohol consumption and not necessarily impairment, poor driving and what have you, all of those can go into the mosaic of probable cause, and for the ADLRO purposes, also a preponderance of the evidence. But you cannot take the person's no to provide additional information as any sort of an inference.
Okay, let's take out that crack tile no. In your particular situation, don't you have very, very erratic driving? You have other indicia, strong indicia of impairment. So let's take out that one tile. Isn't there enough on this record to show probable cause?
Well, first, I would disagree with the court's characterization. The driving was imperfect. It was not as bad as the Wynn case, where the driver exhibited much more significant driving issues. Red and watery eyes and the odor of alcohol is indicative of alcohol consumption, not necessarily impairment. But the problem here is that the underlying hearing officer stated that they used the declination of SFSTs as part of the probable cause analysis, an inference that was used against Ms. Gleason. And the way he phrased it was, Ms. Gleason hasn't given me any reason to not presume that she was impaired because she declined to perform the SFSTs. That is fraught with all sorts of difficulties because a person is being put in the position where they either have to provide evidence to the police, which is subjective and can be used against them, or if they just decline, which is what she was told she could do. This is a voluntary test. You can decline to do it, and she did. All of a sudden now, there's a presumption that she cannot overcome. And that runs, I believe, directly contrary to Ichima and
Tsuchimura. I'm sorry, you're saying that she was told it was voluntary?
They asked her, I don't think they used the word voluntary, they said, would you agree to perform them? I think it's implied. We don't have the specific words from the ADLRO hearing officer that
that that was stated, the word voluntary, but I believe in the police reports, they asked her if she would agree to, which implies that it is voluntary. They're asking for her consent or her assent to the procedure.
To make sure I understand, you're contesting probable cause without the inference.
I'm saying that you cannot add the inference to the probable cause analysis, and here that was done. If the inference was taken out, I do not take a position as to whether or not there was probable cause. I think it is certainly arguable. I disagree, Justice Edens, that it was very strong that there was probable cause. Certainly, it could be argued under the Mosaic analysis that there was probable cause. The problem is the hearing officer relied on the inference. And whether that's the 1% to get it over the top or whether it was a significant portion, I don't know. My argument is that should not be as part of the analysis at all.
If there was probable cause, what does our case law say with respect to whether or not Miranda warnings must be provided?
So once probable cause is attached, and this attaches even pre-arrest, you would need a Miranda requirement, which is why this is problematic. If the officer believes that there is probable cause based upon Justice Edinson's recitation of the driving and the odor and alcohol and such, before asking for standardized field sobriety tests, they would have to read the person Miranda, which is problematic.
But Uchima says that Miranda warnings are required for custodial interrogation with respect to questions or responses that may be incriminating. Uchima says that the response is not incriminating.
That's right. And that's the direct problem here, is because what FIRM does is allows a negative response to be not only incriminating, but also under Ballesteros, substantial proof of DUI. And I don't know how a driver is to overcome that later at an ADLRO hearing. And it also would implicate their right to testify later at trial. Whereas this is an ADLRO proceeding, FIRM and Ballesteros are criminal cases, and that would mean that a judge in a criminal DUI proceeding could take that inference, and then that puts the pressure on the person to determine whether or not they would be forced to testify in the criminal proceeding. And I think that this was discussed recently in this case under by this court in Zufante, how when you bring together these different rights and you put that pressure on a person, that's not something that the Hawaii Constitution allows.
These ADLRO hearings do often take place before the criminal OVUII charge trial.
I would disagree
correct?
With that.
That's not true? The criminal.
I think in theory that it is what is meant to occur, but typically that does not happen. One of the reasons is that, at least in this circuit, there are at least a moderate, if not a substantial number of times that officers do not appear. And case law from this court allows the hearing officers to continue the case out at least two times if particular officers are served and fail to appear. At the ADLRO, yes. And so that could drag it on, assuming there aren't calendars.
When was this ADLRO hearing?
In relation to the criminal?
Right. What date was it? I can't remember.
I don't remember the date. I would have to.
It was well before the knowledge process of the OVUII, right?
That's correct. I believe it was. Yes, I can't swear that the ADLRO concluded, but I believe that the criminal case took a while before it was dismissed.
So there are situations where the ADLRO hearing will take place before the OVUII trial.
Yes.
And then but whatever the defendant says at the admin ADLRO hearing could potentially be admissible in an OVUII trial?
No, there's a specific statute that disallows anything that's stated at the ADLRO from being later used at the criminal trial.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. So it is the argument of the appellant that because this is in direct conflict with the Uchima case, it would not be appropriate for a hearing officer or a court to be able to use a person's invocation of the right to decline to participate or to provide evidence to the police officer in a criminal investigation after they've been served from now being used as substantial proof of guilt of DUI. It seems to us that in that case, the person's declination to provide evidence to themselves would implicate their it becomes testimonial, and it implicates their right to not have to provide evidence to the court as to the officer, to the hearing officer as well.
You know, I can see that, and I can see your point with FIRM. FIRM was a criminal case, but you know, this is an ADLRO proceeding. Any difference?
So unfortunately, or just as it so happens, the DUI matters are intertwined with both ADLRO and criminal. And because that inference can be used in both under Ballesteros and Firm and Beck, we know it can be used on the criminal side. In cases like Gleason, like this one, we know it is also being used on the ADLRO side. It complicates matters because there's no way to differentiate them. There's no warning that can be given to the driver at the time that would allow them the ability to protect themselves in one arena versus the other because the two are intertwined.
But you just indicated that there's a statute that says that anything a defendant says is not admissible in an ADLRO is not admissible.
If they testify at the ADLRO, but right. At the scene, the pressure that the person is being placed under, they can't differentiate between the ADLRO at then. They cannot make a choice that would work for the ADLRO and not work for the criminal side at the scene when they're with the police officer. And they're not thinking about what can I testify to at the ADLRO later that won't harm me at the criminal side. And I believe I'm approaching 18 minutes, so I don't have a warning, so I'll save my... Oh, no, I'm sorry. My watch is off. So we believe that you also have to consider, and I think that this was referenced both in Wyatt and also in Firm, that there is a privacy right, and the right is the right to be left alone. And I think in a Van Dyke article from 2011, the article discussed the right to privacy here as being the right to be left alone, and Justice Levinson had indicated that if you're not harming anybody else, I think in this case it can be used as a shield as opposed to a sword. The Romano case and other cases that were cited in that Law Review article were attempts by people who were charged with criminal acts to use the right of privacy, specifically stated in the Hawaii Constitution, as a sword. And they were trying it with regard to prostitution. They were trying it with regard to the use of marijuana. But this is neither of those things. This is it being used as a shield. A person does not wish to perform these actions, and they don't have to contribute to the criminal investigation against them, and they have particular privacy reasons why they may not wish to do it. Again, English may be their second language. They might have been tired, or they're just nervous. Any of a variety of reasons why they don't wish to contribute to their own prosecution, I think that this court should also consider looking at the constitutional right to privacy. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. If the rights to due process, privacy, and to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures mean anything, it's this. Refusal to cooperate with police is not synonymous with guilt, and it shouldn't be treated as such. In other words, the system, be it police, hearing officers, or courts, should not be permitted to infer guilt when a driver says they don't want to do voluntary SFSTs. The ICA's contrary holding in State versus Firm should be overruled for two reasons. First, allowing an inference of guilt from refusing SFSTs raises grave due process concerns, particularly because probable cause is a traditionally low standard. And second, this court already held in State versus Uchima and State versus Scapinock that refusing SFSTs is not incriminating. But an inference of guilt would upend those holdings. Sanctioning the ICA's rule in Firm would not only overrule Uchima and Scapinock, but would result in unnecessary constitutional complications that undermine the search for justice.
Let me ask you about those complications, and you refer to them in your brief to a certain extent. So are you suggesting then that that would mean that police officers on the scene would have to advise suspected impaired drivers of Miranda rights? There might be exclusionary rule issues and so on?
Yes, Your Honor. As I believe Justice McKenna referred to during Mr. O'Grady's argument, the necessity of a Miranda warning attaches when someone is in custody, and here in Hawaii, that's when probable cause develops. there are, you know, the potential for questions, certainly from police officers, about do I have enough for probable cause before asking for SFSTs? And this court's holding in Uchima and Skapanok have said, because do you want to do SFSTs doesn't import any information. It's not incriminating. That can be asked without violating Miranda. And because that can be asked without violating Miranda, that means the subsequent performance of SFSTs isn't suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree, even if a court later decides that Miranda warnings should have been given before, say, the medical rule-out questions.
So as I take your argument, unless we corrected things, so to speak, that would result in, for example, blood alcohol content tests, same as Gleason's test, I think it was in 0.14, something of that nature, would have been suppressed under the exclusionary rule.
I think that there's a possibility, depending on whether the court were to decide that the arrest and then subsequent request for the blood alcohol test is fruit of the poisonous tree, if all of that originated with this consciousness of guilt inference, yes.
And that all hinges back to, I guess, the tension and the idea that unless perhaps Firm is corrected and that we would be requiring, if that evidence, the consciousness of guilt evidence, came into play, a roadside Miranda rights, which we don't currently have, right?
Right.
Okay. So, and that's, can you detail a little bit about the tension you've described in your briefing?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think the problem right now is that under Uchima and Skapanok, the holding is this question, will you do SFSTs? It's not incriminating. And what that means is really it's non-probative. In the Miranda context, incriminating includes exculpatory and inculpatory statements, anything that the state might wish to use, you know, down the road. Right now, if it's that this question, will you do that? If it's not incriminating, it's because it doesn't import any information. And I think the court in Uchima and Skapanok wasn't thinking about the possibility of this consciousness of guilt issue. But if consciousness of guilt gets added into this equation and there's this inference that's allowed to happen, there's kind of this leapfrog from, no, I don't want to do SFSTs, and they jump over to, okay, that means that you're guilty of DUI. That makes that answer incriminating because it adds extra weight to it that really wasn't contemplated in Uchima or Skapanok.
Let me ask you this. What if we sort of, or what if the constitutional aspect was taken out and this was just a simple evidentiary matter where you're looking at Rule 403? And I see some of the briefing from both you and Mr. O'Grady that really there is no real rational connection. I mean, you list these, you know, this laundry list of 14 types of alternative reasons that you identify other than consciousness of guilt. I mean, isn't this just a 403 matter?
I believe it could be a 104 matter, Your Honor. State versus Martin was also about an inference of consciousness of guilt. And in that case, it really was kind of a simple evidentiary issue. And the question was, if somebody attempts to commit suicide, can that attempt be used as consciousness of guilt evidence? And this court had said there needs to be kind of an evidentiary inquiry before this evidence could be admitted. And it needs to be more likely than not, because that's the standard for admission of evidence as well. It needs to be more likely than not that the attempt was, in fact, because of consciousness of guilt. There wasn't this kind of automatic inference that was allowed.
Right. But as a practical matter, that's in the criminal case context. And we're talking about an ADLRO hearing, right? So how would that type of hearing take place in an ADLRO hearing?
I mean, Your Honor, that kind of a hearing couldn't happen in an ADLRO proceeding. I think the fact that we're talking about the probable cause standard is actually one of the reasons that this inference is so problematic. Probable cause is a traditionally low standard. It's designed to be flexible, and actually it's designed to be flexible in order to balance the individual right to privacy against the public interest in safety. And so this kind of reasonable, is there a reason to believe a crime is committed? That's supposed to be balancing these rights. But what's happening with this consciousness of guilt inference at the probable cause stage is that in invocation of an individual right to say, hey, I don't want to do this test. I want to keep my own privacy and kind of control my own movements, which is what an SFST is. I want to invoke that right. That then gets used to create the probable cause necessary to override the individual privacy right.
So it sounds like in the agency issue, agencies can't act arbitrarily and capriciously, can they?
Right.
Now, is there a tether to due process if something is arbitrary and capricious and has no rational basis in the inferences you're talking about? So wouldn't that sort of inject, to a certain extent, this Rule 403 analysis into it? Doesn't it sort of, it's somewhat linked into the necessary decisions by an agency to not act arbitrarily and capriciously?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our argument. The U.S. Supreme Court in Leary versus United States had explained that when there isn't a rational connection between the evidence and the inference, that makes the use of the inference arbitrary and capricious. Because there isn't this connection, because there isn't, it's not more likely than not that this inference is in fact true. And so because agencies are prohibited from acting arbitrarily and capriciously, they're also prohibited from violating due process. I think that this rule does apply in the administrative context.
You indicated, I believe your amicus brief indicated about 12 categories of reasons why people may not wish to, might not consent to a field sobriety test. It seems that one was not included. Since the NHTSA manuals, the National Highway Traffic Safety Association manuals on field sobriety tests from the beginning have indicated that as of a certain age, the walk and turn and the one leg stand FSF are not reliable, are considered unreliable for people past a certain age. Originally it was age 60, and now it's age 65. So NHTSA says that SFSTs are not reliable for people over the age of 65. Yet under FIRM, if someone over the age of 65 refused, said, no, I don't want to take it, that could be used as consciousness of guilt?
Yes, that's true, Your Honor, and that's a good point. I think we had included the citation under footnote 16, but we didn't list it as an independent reason, and it absolutely is. And that's part of the problem with allowing a sort of across-the-board inference of consciousness of guilt, is that there's a variety of innocent reasons why somebody might refuse. It might, in fact, be smarter. I was told that Mr. O'Grady's business card says, don't do SFSTs, that he's handing out. So there's a lot of different reasons why someone might refuse. It's not more likely than not that it's because they're guilty.
Doesn't unfair prejudice suggest a decision on an improper basis? Isn't that really what unfair prejudice is, part of the rule of 403?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. Let's see. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I'm out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Sioana Guolano, on behalf of the Administrative Director of the Courts. Applicant and the ACLU treat consent as something that is a given and is necessary here. However, consent derives from the inquiry of whether the Fourth or Fifth Amendment rights are violated. And in this instance,
I'm sorry, which rights?
The Fourth or Fifth Amendment rights. So your right to privacy and against unreasonable searches, and then your right to remain silent and to not provide testimony against yourself. And Gleason first only raised the issue of the Fourth Amendment right to not have unreasonable searches. And here, consent is one of those exceptions to a search when a police officer asks you to do something. And here the SFSTs, as Wyatt has indicated, are not implicating an individual's privacy rights. And so if an individual's privacy rights are not implicated, they don't have a constitutional right to refuse the SFSTs. And so if there's no constitutional right to refuse the SFST, that denial is not protected in any way. And that can be considered as evidence as any other piece of evidence is considered. For example, refusing to provide handwriting samples, which the courts have already considered to not be a search, your refusal can be considered for whether you have something to
hide.
What
was that example again? I'm sorry.
Providing handwriting samples.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Providing handwriting samples are not considered to implicate the constitutional rights of an individual. And so refusing to provide a handwriting sample could be used to indicate possibly that an individual has something to hide. And this is no different.
Even under the, I don't mean to stray, but even under the current status of the understanding of scientific evidence that handwriting analyses are actually basically bogus.
So whether or not there are other reasons to keep the evidence out, it does not, that question does not go to whether it is constitutionally protected and whether you have a Fourth Amendment right to refuse to the SFST. And I think the court's questionings have kind of gotten us there, where the question of whether there are other reasons to deny an SFST goes towards whether maybe the evidence is probative or whether the inference is proper in this context. And FIRM does not require that a court or a hearing officer treat a no as an inference of consciousness of guilt. They are not automatic presumptions. And that is evident in Kuahivinui-Beck, State v. Kuahivinui-Beck, which is an unpublished ICA opinion. But in that unpublished ICA opinion, the ICA noted FIRM, but noted that there was not a proper inference of consciousness of guilt in that situation. So clearly, FIRM does not mandate that inference. And here, with the rest of the indicia of intoxication.
Can I ask you about that? So what's your position on when it would be a permissible inference? Because you're reading FIRM as permissible inferences?
Yeah, it would be a permissible inference.
And when would it be permissible?
Considering all of the other factors surrounding the decision, and in this context, we're considering whether there was probable cause, right? So considering all of the other surrounding information that the officer had at the time, is it permissible to infer that the no was evidence of consciousness of guilt, where you have erratic driving, you have glassy eyes, you have other indicia of intoxication, that no may be permissible?
Well, why would you even need it if you had all those other things? Why would you have, a piece of evidence that may or may not have a rational connection, that may or may not have a reasonable inference, because it could mean other things, if you had everything else? Why would you need that? And then, on the contrary, is it then somehow boosting it if you don't have some of these other things?
So again, whether or not that inference is probative or valuable to consideration, it does not go to whether it just at base is protected by the constitutional and can be considered as admissible. So I think there are two separate questions here. And all we are saying is that the refusal can be admitted and can be considered. Whether there are other reasons to disconsider it or not allow it into evidence, those questions can be later answered.
Well, the classic evidence textbook treatise by McCormick basically says that these permissible inferences or these inferences operate as admissions. And in this case, you're using it as essentially not just tethering it to one element, whether it's knowledge or not. This is the whole ball of wax. The inference here, permissible or not, is impaired driving. So that's everything. And it just seems like, you're cosplaying, you're dressing up an admission and calling it a permissive inference when it's a confession, isn't it?
I would disagree with that construal. And again, in this context, we're talking about the probable cause, whether the officer had probable cause, whether the admission of the refusal for ultimate guilt and consciousness of guilt in the ultimate criminal question of guilt is not before the court today and need not be answered today. Here, all we are considering is whether the officer at the time of arrest, looking at all the information available to them, could use the refusal to infer consciousness of guilt, given all of the other circumstances, to arrest the individual, to conduct a further investigation, etc. For example, to request the BAC. And in this context,
that's the issue in this case, whether the officer could consider it or whether the ADLRO hearing officer could consider it.
Well, the ADLRO officer could consider it for probable cause. And so in this instance, whether the officer properly found probable cause and properly arrested the individual. So when I say officer, I mean, we start at the officer, right? The officer is the one making the inference in the first instance. They are arresting the individual. Then the ADLRO hearing officer is considering whether that was a proper inference.
So it sounds like you're really talking about a rational evidentiary connection. Is that what you're really arguing for?
Yes. So
in terms of when you can make such an inference, when it would be permissible?
Certainly. Firm doesn't require it at any time. Doesn't require the inference be admitted, right? So what we are saying is that firm does not need to be disturbed because it just acknowledges that it can be considered. Whether it should be considered is based on the circumstances and whether it's rationally related to
Let's say these circumstances. Let's say it's the exact same case as Ms. Gleason, and it gets to the point then where the officer says, do you want to take the FST? And what Ms. Gleason does is she pulls out her phone and she shows it to the police officer, and it's a Hawaiian News Now story saying that 127 sober people were arrested, and I'm not going to do this. Is that consciousness of guilt or consciousness that these tests are unreliable?
So that is one piece of the information that the officer has. We don't, in this context here, we don't know has that, when that person was pulled over, what other indicia of intoxication did that officer observe, right? So we cannot treat the refusal in a vacuum, and firm does not state that we should treat the refusal in a vacuum, and we are not arguing that the refusal should be treated in a vacuum, or that standing alone with nothing else, it should be used as an inference.
But you are almost suggesting that because there was other indicia of intoxication, that and the declining of the FST really is just part of the mix. So then that situation that I just told you would be part of the mix then, right?
It would, and it could be considered once the hearing officer, or in a criminal context, once the court considers whether it's rational to come to the conclusion that the no is a
But then isn't it then requiring the suspected drunk driver to actually affirmatively say stuff and almost defend themselves and say something against their right not to say something, their right to refuse?
So, and this goes back to kind of what my first point is the voluntariness is tied to the Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. And if the SFST is not implicating the Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, that voluntariness is not constitutionally protected. So it does not enjoy the same protections as somebody who was asserting their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And in this case, the SFSTs have been held not to implicate the Fifth Amendment. And in Wyatt, it indicates that SFSTs do not implicate the Fourth Amendment, and we would agree with that. And so because the individual's rights are not implicated, their refusal is not protected by the Constitution. And so then that's how we get to whether the inference is properly admitted into evidence. And there are other evidentiary questions, other considerations.
But aren't, I mean, and the ACLU has identified 14, you know, other alternative rationales. We could probably sit collectively and brainstorm another 14. Where is the probative value of that? Where is the value in the probable cause in this particular situation or in firm? Because, again, you're saying that, well, this case is a probable cause case. One of the questions presented is whether we're going to if firm is still good law. And firm was a criminal case involving consciousness of guilt. So where is the connection for this inference to just be injected into whether it's probable cause or with firm, which is the question presented, in the criminal court?
As the question was presented, but again, we are not in the criminal court context. But I think whether there the inference is probative and it has probative value, or, you know, as evidence can serve as any sort of evidence, is a separate question from whether the Constitution protects the refusal and immediately requires that the refusal not be considered. So I think what we are talking about is whether we have this refusal, can it be considered? Does the Constitution prevent it from being considered? And our answer is no, because it is not protected by the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. So yes, it can be considered. And I think that what you are asking is the second question. Is it probative? Should it be admitted? Should it be considered? And all of those questions come after this first question, which is what's really before the court, whether the Fourth and Fifth Amendment protect the refusal.
In the agency context, the agency has to act without being arbitrary or capricious. And that arbitrary, capricious standard is a constitutional standard, a due process standard. So if we just isolate this case to the agency situation, what is your position on whether that piece of evidence that is going to be considered in the probable cause calculus is arbitrary and capricious?
And so in this context, we have a multiple indicia of intoxication. We have the erratic driving, we have the glassy bloodshot eyes, we have slow movement in the car, we have slurring of speech. All of those things preceded the request for the SFST. Then we have that refusal. The officer arrested Ms. Gleason based on those factors. And so before the hearings officer, we have all of those indicia, and those lead a reasonable person to conclude that there was a crime being committed there.
So is this a sliding scale? If you didn't have that matter, and maybe you just had somebody that perhaps didn't have their headlights on, or a lot less indicia of impaired driving, then it's out? I mean, it just seems that we're, rather than having an easier categorical bright line analysis, it's just sort of a sliding ad hoc analysis. Is that what you're proposing?
It is, you know, based on the circumstances. Probable cause is based on the circumstances, so it is very fact intensive. So I don't think just saying that the refusal can or cannot be used really undercuts that initial analysis there.
Could it be used to boost then the situation of somebody who's driving without headlights on?
So if unclear whether if someone was simply driving without headlights on and were pulled over for driving without headlights on, unclear whether the SFST request would make sense.
Well, I'm not sure you could even get them out of the car.
Right. So, like, that's a separate question. And so whether the SFST
is probably... Okay, no headlights, they stumble out of the car, you smell alcohol, and as we know, most times when people are pulled over and ultimately arrested, the police report says they have red, watery, and glassy eyes. That situation.
So if we have indicia of intoxication, again, it would depend on that circumstance. The hearings officer would have to consider all of the things before it, all the things that were before the officer at the time.
Do you think that the portion of Sagopolo Telesilva from the ICA that is raised by the defense here, saying that in which the ICA said that erratic driving and red eyes alone do not constitute probable cause. So do you agree that that is still good law?
I'm not sure if I agree or disagree. I'm not in a position to state.
Let's say here we have the driving plus the red eyes and the odor of alcohol. Let's say there was no odor of alcohol. Are you suggesting then that the inference of the conscious, if the defendant refuses, the driver refuses, that will take it over and create probable cause?
So we have erratic driving and glassy
eyes. Erratic driving and red eyes, but no smell of alcohol.
So
the answer is no to will you submit to a field sobriety test. That would then take it to the probable cause level.
I think that, again, it would, you know, depend on the circumstances. But in that one, I think it's a much closer question, right? Because, again, you would consider, is this probative? And here, can that inference be drawn if you don't have other indicia of intoxication? And that's
ACLU does point out of all these categories, and I raised the additional one, age, where NHTSA clearly says, that SFFTs are not reliable, are unreliable, yet under FIRM and under your analysis, all of this, this would be an inference of consciousness of guilt if an older person refused.
I don't think so. I think that you would consider the age of the individual, and that could be something that weighs
It's going to be case by case. This case, the defendant is saying English was not her first language, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the defense here?
Yes.
That, you know, some people that don't really understand English might not exactly understand what the police officer is saying.
And that goes to whether, you know, was it considered properly, but it doesn't go to whether you could consider it at all in the first instance. And that's what the question before the court is. It's not whether in any individual circumstance.
That potential issue was not considered, right? By the hearing officer here or the court.
So I think that if the court were inclined to, they could clarify FIRM and clarify that while the Constitution does not prevent it from being considered, it should be considered with any kind of evidentiary questions or reliability questions to determine whether that inference is proper in any given circumstance.
Why should a person's refusal to cooperate with the police and not submit to a exam or a test that they don't want to be considered consciousness of guilt?
Well, again,
why should it?
Because in this instance, the law enforcement officer is allowed to ask for the individual to submit to the SFST.
And a person has a right to say no. Why should that be consciousness of guilt?
So there's no constitutional or statutory requirement that necessarily be true. There's no...
There's the statutes say that if you refuse to submit, once there's probable cause and you're taken to the police station and you refuse to submit to a blood alcohol or a breathalyzer test, then, hey, your license is going to be revoked. It's basically the statute says you've consented. By driving on our roads, you've consented to one of these tests. And if you refuse to do it, your license is gone, right?
The blood alcohol test and the SFSTs are distinguishable, I believe.
Right, but the statute, even if the statute did say, hey, if you refuse to submit to an SFST, your license is gone. That issue is not before us. But right now, the statute doesn't say that, right?
The statute doesn't, but the statute doesn't. There's nothing that provides a right to refuse. The statute with relation to the BAC is my understanding is that the BAC does implicate certain rights. So there's the inference of consent.
You're saying a person does not have a constitutional right to refuse to submit to an SFST?
As this court has already found, the Fifth Amendment does not protect SFSTs because they are not testimony. Officers are not seeking testimony. And then as we argue why it has indicated, and we encourage the court to find today, that an individual doesn't have a privacy right in those physical characteristics, those coordinative abilities to drive. And so it does not implicate the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches. And so when you don't have those implications, you don't have that constitutional protection to say no, because you have no protection against that seeking of that evidence. And in Wyatt, the court did state that that assisting the police with collecting evidence isn't protected necessarily. Like, just because you have to assist the police in collecting evidence doesn't mean that you have a constitutional protection in that. You have to ground it in some sort of right, grounded in the Fourth Amendment, grounded in the Fifth. But when we don't have that right here, there's no constitutional protection.
All right. The minority of states that have recognized this, that allowing a inference of guilt, have grounded it on their state constitutional rights against self-incrimination. Is that right? Oregon, Massachusetts, Virginia.
I believe that there are states that have considered the question both under the Fifth and Fourth and have come to different conclusions. There are also states that have come to the same conclusion that we are advancing here.
You're talking about the Fourth and the Fifth, and the Fourth in the sense of, you know, search and seizure, and the Fifth in the sense of self-incrimination. But what about the Fifth due process right? The suspected driver is told it's voluntary. They're told that there's civil consequences if you refuse, but they're not told that if you refuse, this could be used against you in court. And it just seems like that lack of notice is repackaging that admission, a confession, without any knowledge of the person. So aside from the search and the self-incrim, is there not a due process issue here as well?
I'm not fully prepared to intelligently discuss that question because that was not before the court today. First of all, Gleason only raised the Fourth Amendment issue, and the Fifth Amendment issue wasn't fully raised either. It was simply the self-incrimination portion. But I would say that the Supreme Court in South Dakota v. Neville acknowledged that you don't necessarily need to be warned that it will be used against you if you don't have the Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination. It considered a question when the test was considered voluntary in South Dakota. It's not mandated by statute, but also not protected by the Constitution. And so when the officer asked and gave indicated it was voluntary, it was not improper not to warn the individual that it could be used against them if they said no.
We have a tradition here of informed consent, and at least in these contexts. And while it just seems that we're informing the driver about all these things, and then the biggest thing to inform them about is the refusal is going to be used against you in criminal court, and you're looking at long time and stint in jail. The one thing we don't tell them, you know, it's voluntary, but is that really a sound choice they're given?
My understanding of the voluntary consent portion or informed consent, again, ties back to when it's an exercise of your constitutional right. When the refusal is not an exercise of your constitutional right, those analyses fall away. But, you know, the court could indicate that better practice would be to warn an individual, but it's not constitutionally mandated.
And if they did warn the individual, I think you might not ever have field sobriety tests anymore because everybody would refuse.
Right, but
I don't think you'd want that.
Certainly, if everyone refused, though, that in certain circumstances, that refusal can be considered as an inference of guilt.
And therefore ensnare the types of people that Justice McKenna was talking about.
Which then would go toward the consideration of whether that inference is properly made because of the facts and circumstances around it. Thank you for your questions. I encourage.
I'm sorry. So you're not taking the position that the refusal in and of itself automatically gives rise to the inference.
Certainly not.
You're not taking that position.
No.
All right. Thank you.
So we encourage the court to conclude and affirm what was said in Wyatt, that the SFSTs don't implicate the Fourth Amendment rights. We encourage the court not to disturb any of its findings that the SFST question and the SFSTs themselves do not implicate the Fifth Amendment, and to affirm firm in the sense that it simply allows for the refusal to be considered. Additionally, that this court can find that even without that inference, in this case, there was probable cause to arrest Ms. Gleason. Thank you.
I just want to make it clear that we are actually discussing the state constitution here and not the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. So we're actually discussing Article 1, Section 7, and Article 1, Section 10, because clearly this, I agree that the United States Supreme Court would probably not accept this type of argument from the defense. So if this is, the inference is permissible, which is also permissible in criminal cases, and say the defendant actually did refuse to submit to a field sobriety test because of age or physical infirmity or language issue, so then the defendant would be required to testify to say, I didn't submit to the test because I am, you know, over a certain age, or I have physical ailments, and or I have a language issue and I didn't understand what the police officer was saying.
So unclear whether they would actually have to testify, but evidence of those other reasons for refusing can be considered and can be.
How could they be considered presented if there's no such evidence because the defendant refused? If the defendant refuses a test and refuses to testify, I mean, and doesn't respond at the police station, how does that evidence come in?
Well, I think, for example, the age would be indicated on their driver's license and the information that's collected at the time, and then the defense attorney may use any sort of evidence that is admissible at the time to point to reasons why that no could have been for other reasons at the time. So I think that there are ways.
Do you happen to know whether or not for old people they're told that they don't need to submit to an SFST?
No.
And if they're not, and if they do and they don't perform well on an SFST, whether that is used against them at an ADLR hearing?
I don't have that specific information, and I also note that, like, I think officers are aware that the tests are not validated for individuals of a certain age, so
we don't know whether it's being used or not.
Yeah, so we couldn't say whether it's being used or whether it was properly being used.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for your arguments today. I think you've presented your points very, very well. I wanted to go back to the due process, too, and not a due process notice issue, but really the due process limits on permissive inferences. Do you think there's a due process issue with permissive inferences?
Generally, I'm not in position to say whether there's a due process issue with permissive inferences generally without more information.
Because it seems like with this particular permissive inference, you're treating a refusal as a confession. And it would seem that with most permissive inferences, the analysis isn't just evidentiary, but it's due process. If the inference really isn't there, then a person's due process rights are implicated. Do you have a position on that?
I think, again, that goes to whether the inference is appropriate, and that's a different question as to whether it can be considered in the first instance. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grady?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If I may address some of my colleagues' points. With regard to non-testimonial evidence such as voice exemplars and handwriting samples, the cases there have all occurred after there was already a determination of probable cause, and in almost all cases these were compelled, usually following a court order or some other exception to the warrant requirement. With regard to Wyatt, in the Wyatt case, the Wyatt court itself stated that it does not follow from our earlier ruling that SFSTs are not testimonial, that the constitutional prescriptions of unreasonable searches, seizures, and invasions of privacy also were not implicated in the field sobriety test. And again, in Wyatt, the reason that there wasn't any real problem was Ms. Wyatt agreed to perform the standardized field sobriety test.
I mean, you keep going to Wyatt. I mean, look, Wyatt was an 84 case. I mean, the issues you're really arguing are something, don't you think, that kind of been thought about over 40 years?
With regard to...
Isn't this a case beyond Wyatt?
This is beyond Wyatt because it is all about firm. It's with regard to the declination of the performance of the field sobriety tests. Wyatt did not address the declination of the performance of field sobriety tests because Wyatt, she performed them. With regard to, I think one of the closest things that needs to be addressed with regard to the government's argument that there's no implication here with regard to any constitutional right is the Boudet close matter. And the Boudet close matter, this court stated rather recently that when a person declines to perform a reenactment of something, that that person has effectively decided to invoke their right to remain silent, and you could not use it against them. And here, again, we have the tension with Uchima. If a person says, no, they're not going to perform the standardized field sobriety test, it's being converted into a confession and then being used as substantial proof of evidence. With regard to the implied consent test, Justice McKenna, implied consent and everything that flows from that is after a probable cause determination has been already been made for a proper arrest. And the implied consent statutory scheme work that is in place that is attached to the driver's license, as Justice Evans pointed out, people already have notice of this. So there's several layers of protection there. And the person has read the implied consent documentation when they're at the station. So none of that applies beforehand, because what they're trying to do is an inference here is an inference for the officer to establish probable cause in the first place. You would be punishing a person for declining to aid in the production of evidence such that you can get to probable cause, whereas in implied consent, the probable cause has already been made.
You know, Justice Edens, I think, raises a really interesting issue regarding inferences and the due process clause, and I don't think you really argued it. But it does appear that we have case law saying that for an inference to be constitutional, there has to be a natural and rational evidentiary relationship between the facts proven and the ultimate fact, which is this is a statutory inference. But, you know, we're talking about a common law inference under firm. So is there a natural and rational evidentiary relationship between refusal to submit to a SFST and consciousness of guilt?
There is not. And I think the closest thing that I raised in my initial underlying motion that I filed with the ADLRO was a Florida case. I believe it's Taylor. And in that case, the Florida court pointed out that the inference that they were able to make was because there was no reasonable explanation other than his inference of guilt, because Mr. Taylor in that particular case had indicated that he knew the consequences of refusal. He had gone over the consequences with his attorney prior. He had prior DUI arrests, and he was aware of the consequences that would occur at that particular time. And they said in those particular circumstances, it was okay because there was this overwhelming amount of evidence that that was the only reason he was declining to perform. Here we don't have that. There would be no rational basis for that. Justice Edens, you mentioned that if everyone was aware that they could refuse, that they would, but I would caution the court to believe that way because, of course, people have the right to decline searches. People have the right to decline to provide statements. Yet every day, defense attorneys deal with people who provide access to their persons, to their cars, to their bags, and they make incriminating statements, even at the police station.
Your time is run if you want to wrap it up.
Yes, I apologize. I've concluded unless there are any further questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the arguments. This matter will be taken under advisement by the court. Thank you.
Please rise. Ua ho'oku'u ia mai nei kea aha ho'okolokolo ki iki hanohano o ka mahu aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.